Good morning, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone. I'm a naturopathic physician and herbalist, author, and natural products consultant. And along with the natural nurse, Dr. Kamai, we bring you this fascinating radio program about issues in health, wellness, and alternative medicine today. We have a guest today, but before that, remember you can always get a list of our walks, talks, eco-tours, and other events at naturalnurse.com or drznaturally.com, naturalnurse.com or drznaturally.com. We're doing all kinds of interesting fun shops, herbal fun shops this summer. So if you're local and around the tri-state New York, Connecticut, New Jersey area, please join us. So today we have a very interesting guest. We have another herbalist with the American Herbalist Guild, but Dr. Patrick M. Fratellone. I don't know if it's Fratellone or Fratellone. I don't know if we want to say it the Italian way, but prior to being chief of medicine and director of cardiology, he was an herbalist, and he held many different positions as medical directors in various prestigious medical groups and directors of cardiology programs, and he is certainly recognized as a forerunner in many of these different fields. He attended SUNY Stony Brook, my alma mater. Also, he trained in London and did many residencies all over the place in cardiovascular disease, trained at Nicholas Institute Sports Medicine and Athletic Trauma, so he knows a lot about herbs and trauma medicine, which is we'll talk a little bit about today. But he's one of the few cardiologists with integrative medicine degree from U Arizona under Dr. Andrew Weil. He also trained with a colleague of mine who I had the opportunity to be roommates with and really hang out and talk into the wee hours of the night, and he's a fabulous herbalist, Seven Song, who's also a member of the American Herbalist Guild. And Patrick is president of New York chapter of the American Herbalist Guild. So we want to talk about herbs as a viable integrative therapy, particularly focusing on cardiovascular disease and maybe trauma and all kinds of things like that. Welcome, Dr. Patrick.
Thank you so much. Thank you both.
So is it the Italian way, Fratellone or Fratellone?
It depends what patient is sitting in front of me.
Okay. Yeah, either one.
That's funny because I'm Venetian and my name doesn't end in a vowel, so people look at it and say Zamperone. It sounds Italian, but it doesn't end in a vowel, and that's because a lot of people from Venice up there, that
correct,
the name doesn't end in a vowel. It's very interesting. So, well, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Tell us a little bit about, like, was herbal medicine like an afterthought after you thought of being a doctor or some type of a genesis, or what was your creation myth?
Well, actually, I wanted to go to vet school.
Uh-huh.
And actually applied to veterinary school in the early 80s, and I got into medical school instead. Would have gone to Bastyr if Bastyr was opened at that point, but it wasn't. I probably would have been an MD. So I went the MD route, but I've been using herbs from my parents and grandparents since childhood, so I always knew about herbs. And my first job after finishing two fellowships, I did infectious disease in Cornell, and I did cardiology at Lenox Hill, all in Manhattan. I decided to take a job with Dr. Robert Atkins.
Mm-hmm.
So Dr. Atkins, where I ran his center until he died, he really taught me a lot about supplements based on his Vita Nutrient book, The Vita Nutrient Solution. And that got me started. He introduced me to Andrew Weil, and when Dr. Atkins passed away, I decided to take a sabbatical as the center was dismantling and do a fellowship with Andrew Weil.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got into herbal medicine. And there I met Dr. Tirana Lowdog, as you know.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, listen, you should really try to get be a registered herbalist. And I said, yeah, that's great. Can I do it? She said, well, you could take some courses. I took a lot of courses, David Winston. I studied with Seven Song.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got, they granted me my AHG about 4 years ago.
Very nice. Excellent.
So it's very
welcome.
Nice. So I'm an MDRH.
Yes, yes.
So that's fun.
You know, botanical medicine is extremely important and has such a, you know, an ancient history. When we look at it in its application for cardiovascular disease, we see that the herbs tend to not be myopic. In other words, they tend to act in multi facets, multifunctioning, balancing things, and also dealing with some of the underlying issues in cardiovascular disease, like, for instance, inflammation. But before we talk about that, why is being that you've been in the trenches of mainstream cardiology, why are they missing the message here with inflammation, and why are they so focused on the cholesterol myth in a way?
Well, you know, that is true, and I don't focus on that. I focus on a CRP. I focus on methylation today. I focus on, you know, the cause. I mean, they want to know the cause, but they won't delve into it. They're still fixated on bringing your LDL cholesterol, which is a bad one, less than 70. I could do that by using, you know, green tea, polycosanol, red rice yeast. I mean, I can use so many things. I can use so many plants, artichoke. So they just don't get it, and it really is the inflammation. And I start with the gut in my practice, meaning I'm not a gastroenterologist, but I actually focus on the gut first to heal the gut, because I believe that is the gateway to all disease.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the homocysteine.
Yes.
What is that for the listeners who don't understand that, and how does it make a big difference in cardiovascular and other inflammatory disease?
Well, homocysteine is a bad amino acid. It's derived from a good essential amino acid called methionine. And basically you need, you know, B12 and folic acid to convert. The problem is, in 1969, a real great story is Dr. McCulley at Harvard studied about homocysteine. He said this was a risk factor for heart disease. He studied 100,000 nurses. He gave them B12 and folic acid, and he reduced the homocysteine by 85%. They kicked him out of Harvard in 71. He continued to work on homocysteine, and then he got his Nobel Prize in the 80s for his work. So it is a risk factor. It is an inflammatory risk factor. And what was more important is, out of that study, even though 85% of patients did have a decrease in this bad amino acid that causes blockage. It causes intimal thickening of the carotids, which is the blood vessel to the brain, and it causes a risk factor for stroke, kidney disease. So you have to bring it down, and I bring it down less than 7, but he found that 85% of the people in the 1970s did bring down their homocysteine, but there was 15% that didn't, and that's where the methylation gene comes in, which is now, hopefully, in the integrative field, a new aspect, a new area of medicine. So I check homocysteine as this risk factor. I make sure that patients have the right folic acid and B12 to take, meaning that if they have this gene defect, they have to take a methylated folic acid and a methylated B12. It's a great way to practice medicine.
Yeah, so for many years, I guess people would, you know, get folic acid from their multivitamin. It would be the regular folic acid, and you're basically saying if they're carrying this gene, it was fairly worthless, this particular type of folic acid, to make sure that this Mr. Hyde homocysteine didn't build up.
Correct. And, you know, there's so many people out there, and you know this, you both know this, that they're still taking regular folic acid and regular B12 and have never had this genetic test.
Yeah, I think it certainly is one of those doctors of the future type of statements, and hopefully that's now with some of the integrative doctors out there. So now there's another big risk factor that is interesting, which is the CRP. Explain that for the listeners out there.
Well, you know, CRP, I've been doing CRP work. It stands for C-reactive protein, which is an inflammatory risk factor. There's two types. The general CRP talks about body inflammation. Most of us, if we're older, that you get arthritis, a little bursitis, you'll have a high regular CRP. I test for the high HS, or high sensitive, or they call the cardiac CRP. And this is a special inflammatory risk factor that really increases your heart disease risk if you have this risk factor. It's a conventional blood test. Doctors should do it. We want less than 1 is normal. 1 to 3 is a moderate risk that increases your risk of heart disease by 3 times. However, if it's greater than 3 and less than 10, you almost have a 7 times risk of having a myocardial infarction, which is a heart attack or a stroke. So you want to make sure your doctor does this. The problem I have in the conventional world is you get a high CRP, you have a high cholesterol and LDL, they throw you on a statin, and they hope that the CRP goes down. And that's not the way. Yeah. I search for the cause.
Well, that's what I was going to say, Dr. Fratelloni. There's infinite insults that happen to your artery, the endothelium. You can have hemodynamic insults, pressure and viscosity and flow insults, and then you can have all the biochemical and other insults, like, for instance, there's even microbial insults that are very interesting, nutritional and metabolic, like we talked about the homocysteine, environmental toxins like certain heavy metals and things like that we check for in integrative medicine to that insult the artery. So if you don't stop the insults, why are you treating...
But that's the problem.
The fireman who comes to the fire.
Right. I want to get, like you're saying, I want to get to the cause. So the workup for a high CRP includes environmental toxins, includes food allergy testing, includes bugs, microbiomes, organisms, whether it's virus, EBV, Epstein-Barr virus, can be one of these viruses.
Oh, yeah, that can affect the heart, too?
Absolutely.
Wow, okay.
H. pylori, which we always think about stomach, affects the heart.
Wow.
So, and they found this out. What really is kind of disturbing is that they did catheterizations on plaque. They sucked out the plaque through an atherectomy, which is like a Roto-Rooter device. They go in and take out all the plaque. They send it to the path lab, which is the pathology lab, and the pathologist comes back with 17 different microbes that were identified.
So, in their gook, in the plaque, in their arteries,
different organisms.
They found 17 microbes. Now, are some of these normal or some of these pathogens or what?
Well, some of them are normal, just like, for instance, you have like MAR, which is a bacteria, a TB, a typical bacteria that lives normally in 2% of our lungs. There are some normal bacteria in the cardiovascular plaque, but H. pylori is not a normal bacteria in the heart. They've now found that it's normal sometimes in the gut, and we try to eradicate it. What I'm trying to tell people is herpes virus has been found. EBV, CMV, mycobacteria, which is the TB bug, has been found, but another one, mycoplasma, which is an atypical bacteria, which I call the self bacteria. They're like spirochetes. They hide in and out. So instead of treating the cause, like give a natural antibiotic, give Yarrow, give something to get rid of it, they'll probably put the person on erythromycin. They're treating a cholesterol. So it's a Band-Aid what they're doing. It's a Band-Aid approach. And that's not what I do, not what you do. I'd rather have a preventative approach and find out why they're building up the bacteria.
Yeah, that's maybe there's a problem with their immune system or the, like you said, they have leaky gut and there's translocation of microorganisms. You mentioned leaky gut and its connection to the heart and inflammation all over the place. What is leaky gut?
You know, it's a term that we throw around. I think the equivalent term in conventional medicine would be irritable bowel. That's their term. Our term is leaky gut. It's where there's an insult to the villi of the small intestines. And how I talk about this, and I wrote a forward to a book recently, My Journey with Celiac Disease. It was written by Jennifer Esposito, who's a patient. And I described to her on her first visit, even though she has celiac disease, she's been insulted by other things besides gluten. So the insult could be food. So it could be a gluten allergy or a gluten sensitivity. It could be a milk allergy or a milk sensitivity. Or it could be any food. Another insult could be too much yeast buildup, which is candida.
Mm-hmm.
Another insult could be heavy metals, such as mercury, aluminum, arsenic. So there's many insults to the small intestine. So I describe the small intestines with a patient in front of me that their small intestines looks like a shag rug. And each villi is the pull of the shag rug. That's how we want our intestines to look. When it's insulted, it does two things. It either becomes bumpy Berber or flat. And you know what? The people get it. it's really interesting. They said, oh, my God, that's what my gut looks like. And I said, yes, and if we did an endoscopy, the doctor would say you have flat villi or you have sort of wavy villi, but they're not that shag rug. So being from England, I say I want to get the shag back in their life. a little different play on the word shag, and they get it. And what I do is we have to heal the gut. If there's inflammation in the small intestines, it starts spreading to give you inflammation of the thyroid, and there where you could get autoimmune thyroiditis Hashimoto's. You could get inflammation of the heart where the CRP goes up. You could get inflammation of the neurotransmitters of the brain, because if you have an insult and leaky gut, it means you have a low vitamin D and a low serotonin. So now the person is like, wow, you mean my depression could be related to what I eat? I said, yes, and also if you have a low serotonin, your body's putting out too much epinephrine, so now you have anxiety. Your body's putting out too much of another neurotransmitter called GABA, and now you have sleep disturbance. And your body is decreasing your dopamine, and you have concentration problems. And if you explain it with this schematic of this rug, they get it.
Yeah. And that's why, back to herbs, our favorite subject, that's why things like putting people on turmeric to balance the toll-like receptors, these are kind of receptors that they found, not only in the gut, but they've actually found some of these toll-like receptors in the arteries and whatnot.
Correct.
And that.
Yes.
And like a toll, like the bridge toll, using another analogy, you know, you can get a backup because everyone has to pay their. There's no easy pass on, in your arteries. Everything gets checked by your immune system before it's allowed into the general body. But the problem is that these toll-like receptors are like alarms. It's like a guy trying to beat the toll, and then all of a sudden the bells and whistles go off, and the immune system gives chase to these scoff laws trying to get through and causing all kinds of problems there. So I know one of my favorite interventions, and it's very good scientifically proven nutraceutical, would be curcuma or turmeric that tends to down-regulate these toll-like receptors, because I know we try to treat upstream inflammation, like in inflammation in the cells versus downstream, like using aspirin and some of these NSAIDs would be kind of more like downstream inflammation.
Correct. And so, I like curcumin.
You like curcumin?
Yeah.
What about green tea? That seems to be you mentioned green tea briefly. Is that one of your favorite botanicals for the
heart?
No,
it's not. I mean, I think it's the most widely studied herb.
Okay.
I think that. I wrote a review about green tea for the Journal of Health and Healing in 2009. I did a 64-page review. I reviewed 64 articles, myself and a nutritionist, Dr. Pastore. And, you know, there's great benefits to green tea. I think more needs to be done. But people think green tea is the all-around tea. Yes, it has studies on heart, cancer, diabetes. I think it's a great herb. The problem is you have to use a lot of it. And people think drinking two cups, they're going to get the effects that's described in these papers. And unfortunately, that's not the case. You would have to drink 36 cups of green tea to get the study effects. So that's where people do high-dose EGCG, which is the catalin component of green tea that is active. And you have to do a high percentage of it. So you have to get anywhere from an 80% content of EGCG for green tea. I think it's a great herb. It's used widely. I think there's other herbs for the heart that are better.
Do tell.
Well, for example, for arrhythmias, let's say for arrhythmias, I do a combination of motherwort, Leonorcus. I do scotch broom. Hawthorn is, I guess, my favorite herb for the heart. And I like Lily of the Valley, but use it with caution. So, I mean, I have a whole arrhythmia section of herbs that I use with medicine. So I think it's fun for me as a cardiologist to, I know the interactions of the conventional medicines such as calcium channel blockers like Cardizem, beta blockers like Toprol, and I do a combination of both herbal tinctures or tea with the actual drugs.
And you, with understanding that some of these things have not been well studied, but we go back to the I know you studied with David Winston. He's a brilliant herbalist, particularly in the eclectic tradition. So these were medical doctors like yourself that in the 1800s, late 1900s, really did so much clinical work on herbs and how they're used in interactions and things like that. It seems like we've thrown away this old information in medicine, and we say, oh, we don't know how these herbs really work on humans. Well, we really do if we go back and look at the
correct. And that's the a clinical. Shame. You know why that happened? Because the AMA was formed.
So
once the American Medical Association was formed, these eclectic physicians who were MDs, who knew a lot about botanical medicine, were really pushed aside.
Right. So then it became more pharmaceutically.
It became a business.
Mm.
And that's the shame in medicine today. It's easier for a doctor to write a prescription for a statin rather than sit and explain the mechanism of what actually causes blockage and giving them certain herbs for inflammation, ginger, turmeric, anti-inflammatory herbs. I mean, it's easier for a doctor to write a prescription because in reality, doctors don't have enough time. I mean, if you think about insurance and the drugs, they're controlling how we practice. Not the way I practice, but how general physicians practice.
How did these statins gain so much stature in medicine? What was the story behind the statins?
Well, the story behind the statins is the inflammatory component, as far as my point. But there are large studies that high-dose statins do decrease risk of mortality and morbidity from cardiovascular disease. What it doesn't talk about is the side effects at what expense. So everyone thinks of the side effects of statins just being liver. You know, we have myopathy. We have decreased sex drive. We have depression. There's a lot to about statins. And also, it's also good to look at the genetics. So as an MD, I could order certain ApoE testing, which is a gene, the ApoE gene. And there is a heart disease gene called ApoE3-4. And someone came in yesterday in my office and they said, listen, I have the ApoE3-4, what should I do? And he said, I already went to a doctor who put me on high-dose statins. Well, actually, when you look at the study of statins, that if you have the ApoE gene 3-4, which increases your risk for heart disease, statins are contraindicated. The treatment is dietary and oils.
Mm.
So we missed the boat someplace because it's just fast medicine. It's like a fast clinic, and I don't think doctors spend enough time talking to patients where I enjoy spending an hour with the patient.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have to find out about. And statins, you know, back to your question, statins, there's bad effects. The reason why it's a big role that they're on it, it's a very cheap drug. Right now it's generic, so you could get Lipitor generic. Except Lipitor wasn't the statin that was studied for particle size. So everyone's worried about their cholesterol number. I, as a cardiologist, look at what particle size do you have, meaning if you have a cholesterol of 130 and mine is 170, which is not the case, but this is our LDL. I might have a good particle with my LDL 170 and you have a bad particle. Particle is the size, which means that you're at more risk by having a small particle than I am having a good particle. No doctors do this testing. And it's a valid test. It's called particle size. So it was discovered in Berkeley. It's called the Berkeley Heart Lab test. Since then, we have many versions of it. But when a patient comes to me fasting, I do a particle test because I want to get a person off a statin.
When you're looking at the particles, let's backtrack a few pegs here. What people throw around LDL and HDL like, we all know about it. We know
okay,
about
I'll define
it for
it.
Physicians.
Yeah.
What are those things?
Okay, so these are lipoproteins. So when you get a measurement, the doctor does four things. He measures your total cholesterol, which doctors from the American Heart Association want less than 200. The LDL stands for low-density lipoprotein. This is the bad cholesterol. The HDL is the high-density lipoprotein. That's the good cholesterol. And we even have a VLDL, which is the very low density protein. And then we have triglycerides. Okay. Most people fixate on LDL, which is the bad cholesterol. The number has changed drastically for what is the correct number. They now have it down to less than 100.
So what do these proteins do, Dr. Fratellone? Do they sweep the cholesterol, the fats out of the body? Why does our body make these proteins?
Okay, so we make these proteins to protect our body. So the low density, their molecular weight is low, and as you said, they do sweep and you try to clean the arteries. The problem is with free radical damage, which could be environment, dietary, we oxidize this LDL, and then it sticks and becomes glue-like and bad.
Uh-huh. So it becomes sticky protein.
Correct. And when it sticks, if it's a small sticky protein, it will stick to the artery. But if the particle size of your LDL is fluffy, it could flow through the artery. So it's not so much about the insult, but it's what your size genetically your parents gave you. If they gave you an LDL that is all small, if it becomes oxidized, you're going to have a problem. But if they gave you a particle size that's fluffy genetically, it won't stick. It might become oxidized, but it won't stick. It will flow through the arteries.
I see. So most of this genetic information is kind of new. Most doctors in the past would just treat all LDLs as if they were the same, had the same effects.
Correct, and that's the problem I have. So you could have an LDL that's lower than mine, but you're more at risk because your particles are oxidized small particles, mine are large particles. And I flow through the artery, I'll never get heart disease if I have a large particle, no matter what my number is.
Oh, that's a very interesting point to make to listeners. Did you hear that? So even if your LDL is higher, and I guess genetically in certain people, maybe, you know, hunter-gatherers or certain people that are more prone to eat more protein or do better on protein. We'll talk about that in a bit.
Right.
Get back to the herbs. But so that's kind of genetics. And then
correct.
I guess if you understand that, you can then decide what the intervention should be.
Correct. And so the thing is, a person comes to me, sometimes they come to me to just do a consult and review all their labs and review all their medications because they want to go take an integrative approach. So they might have an LDL of 160 and the doctor never fractionated into small particles or large particles. I tell them, let's do a fasting test. Let's find out if you actually need the statin. If they come out fluffy, maybe they never needed the statin.
Mm.
Now, if they're on Lipitor and they're fluffy, they definitely never needed the statin because Lipitor is not a medication that changes particle size, which means they were always fluffy.
Right.
So doctors are just treating numbers, and that's not what it's about.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at the time. We're going to take a quick break.
Okay.
And regroup and ID the station. And then when we return, we'll get back into some herbs and alternative treatment protocols. I'd like to talk a little bit about hypertension, some other things, and then, of course, tell us a little bit about the top 10 herbs and supplements that you recommend for people with heart disease, and then also your philosophy, which you're sharing freely with us. So stay tuned right here to Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and we'll be back with more. And we're back with the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z with Dr. Patrick Fratellone, who's a medical doctor and a registered herbalist and also a cardiologist and just a brilliant physician in the integrative field, trying to bring this information down so that we understand it as listeners, and we welcome him back.
Thank you.
Great. So we were talking about a lot of the risk factors and the size of the particles and things like that. What about this whole epidemic of dysglycemia, where we're seeing people with higher than normal blood sugars? And should we be treating that with herbs as part of our cardiovascular risk preventive medicine program?
100% correct. One of the important risk factors on your cholesterol panel has nothing to do with the LDL, which is the bad, or the HDL, which is the good. It has to do with triglycerides. And that's where you start to see the dyslipidemia which affects heart disease. And this is called Syndrome X, insulin resistance metabolic syndrome. And it's been studied, and I think people are finally catching on, that when you have a high triglyceride level, which is the amount of fat, which comes from carbohydrates. So if you eat a high refined carbohydrate diet, you will have a very high triglyceride level. And there's an inverse proportion, which means if your triglyceride is high, you will have a low HDL, which is a good cholesterol. That is the most important risk factor for heart disease. Mm. Because once that happens, insulin starts happening. So we're in an epidemic, and I hopefully that the medical community has realized that we have an epidemic of two things, obesity and diabetes, and both lead to heart disease. That's the twin epidemics which are out of control, and it's affecting not only adults, but as we know, children.
Yeah.
And it's really, you are what you eat. You know, Marion Nestle's right, and I look at Adele Davis's work, as you know, an old nutritionist, and, you know, it's right. It's not only you are what you eat, but you have to have a clean gut. So that's where I come back to the gut. But your dietary is so important. So the dyslipidemia is once the triglycerides go up and the HDL drops, blood sugar goes up. So after so many insults of someone eating refined carbohydrates, the blood sugar is all over the place. And they used to call that hypoglycemia. It really should be called unstable blood sugar. So for me, the first stage of diabetes is unstable blood sugar, which means you're just eating carbs out of control. So blood sugar goes up and down, and every time the sugar drops, the person is in what I call a 12-step term called HALT, hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. And most of the patients experience that at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and you always ask them, what do you grab? They go to the candy machine, they have a Coke, they might have a coffee with a cookie. Very few patients, very few individuals that aren't patients of mine, will grab that. They'll grab the good stuff like a handful of almonds, walnuts, a green apple.
Right.
So they keep going up and down. After a while, the pancreas, which is so important to produce insulin in the beta cells, the islets of Langerhans, going back to medical school, insulin is put out in the pancreas and the blood sugar is high. But the person has been doing so much up and down all day that the insulin comes out and it's supposed to go down, and now it stays up. That is the second stage of diabetes, which I call insulin resistance. And that's what you and I are just talking about. We're talking about when there's a dyslipidemia due to triglycerides, we now get insulin resistance. Insulin is a fat-storing hormone.
Wow, that's a very that says it very succinctly.
That says it. And now there are new ones which I test, which no one knows about, leptin levels. Leptin is another fat-storing hormone. So I do a fancy lipid test, but I also do a very fancy insulin glucose test where I want to look at, everyone knows the fasting glucose they look at. They always look at the two-month marker called the hemoglobin A1C. I look at fructosamine, which is a two-week marker for blood sugar. I look at leptin levels.
Hmm.
I look at fasting insulin and proinsulin and C-peptide. I don't think endocrinologists even look at that.
What's the C-peptide?
A C-peptide is another marker for insulin, and it's basically like a proinsulin. They both start to get elevated before insulin gets elevated. So that I consider them the precursors. So as I'm explaining this to the patient, I'm saying, listen, I'm trying to prevent diabetes. Why? You have a family history.
Yeah.
Will you become a diabetic? It depends on your dietary lifestyle. So once I see that they're insulin resistant, and even the young females who are insulin resistant, now I have to check how their estrogen levels are because they could have polycystic ovarian syndrome, which is another risk factor for diabetes. And if it's a risk factor for diabetes, you're at risk for heart disease. So in all, I think everyone in the United States is at risk for heart disease.
Yeah. And so the getting back to the herbs now, there's some great herbs that,
wonderful,
that kind of help people with diabetes and foods, too.
Correct.
So well, what would be some of the things that you would recommend the patient, say?
Well, first of all, cinnamon is great. Nice studies on cinnamon.
How much? So you're talking like a spoonful on your oatmeal or what?
No, I actually have people drink, I take cinnamon sticks. And I have them do 2 to 3 cups of cinnamon in a, so the stick, steep the stick in water, and at 2 to 3 cups. But they're also doing cinnamon in a glucose formula. A lot of the glucose formulas I use have
herbs and supplements. So a combination of fenugreek, rosemary, cinnamon, bitter melon. I'm just throwing out herbs that I use.
Sure.
And then with that, I use great supplements like chromium, picolinate at high dose, vanadyl sulfate, which is vanadium, and alpha lipoic acid. So when you get a combination of three great supplements, nutraceuticals, with three to four great herbs, you don't need the metformin.
That's right. I've seen that. Yeah, many times in the office here. Yeah.
So that's a great thing. Now, then, you know, foods as well, that's a whole, you know, people say, well, you know, you work for Atkins, do you believe in the Atkins diet? I said, well, you know what I believe in? I believe he really changed the way people think. He's definitely right. He was right about low-carbohydrate lifestyle. That we know. He wasn't right about the fat content and the high protein. Because every diet that's out there now, and there are like 140 diets on the market, they were all derivatives of Atkins. Meaning, they all have low carbohydrate. Now, some of them, moderate protein, moderate fat, but not coming from animals.
Yeah.
Then you have a low no-oil diet. Now you have paleo. There's even a God-maker's diet out there. Really, he had it right. He didn't have the fat content and the protein. So if someone said, what's your typical? They say, oh, Dr. Farrell, please tell me, what is your diet? I said, well, listen, let me tell you this. There's no diet forever. You cannot read a diet in a book and say follow it. Everyone is individualized. You have to do your glucose levels. You have to do your insulin levels. We have to do food allergy testing. But I will tell you this. It is a Mediterranean diet without the bread and the pasta.
So have your organic meat sauce over bitter vegetables like broccoli rabe.
People say that, yeah, and they say, well, you're Italian.
That's what I do. I'll make a nice organic meat sauce with the organic meats and grass-fed meat put some vegetables in there, a lot of different vegetables in the sauce, let it cook down, and then I'll have that over a bed of kale and broccoli rabe and skip the, or sometimes we'll get some spaghetti squash. We really try to get rid of the gluten because I really do think it's not a fad. I really do think that there's a big problem. And I'm doing some, it's interesting, I'm writing a paper on the work of the famous doctor from Ohio who discovered zonulin.
Right.
And anyway, the doctor, I forgot his name, Fasano or something like that?
Yeah.
Dr. Fasano looked at these inflammatory markers from the gluten and, you know, kind of put leaky gut, although functional medicine doctors like yourself and myself have been talking about it. I remember Dr. Jeff Bland talking about it when I was in school 25 years ago.
Correct.
But now it's become, wow, okay, leaky gut. So hopefully it'll...
You and I considered like functional medicine doctors and we didn't go through the whole program.
Yeah.
Well, really?
I got out of Bastille and Dr. Bland was a professor there back then.
Right.
So
you know, I'm glad you said it's not a fad because I have celiac disease, and that's why I did the forward for Jennifer's book. So for me, it is definitely not a fad. But there is people out there, I think everyone is gluten intolerant, but to say it's a fad, the AMA had to look at this very carefully, and they said, you know what? There are people who have celiac, and then there's people who have non-celiac gluten sensitivity that's so bad that they can't have gluten, but they're not celiac.
Yeah.
That's not a fad. So
well, it's probably because of the when if you look at Fasano's work, which I'm actually reading his paper and preparing for a conference that I'm going to be doing some work with this. You actually look at the structure of gluten. There's a part of it that makes the immune system crazy. There's a part of it that stimulates the zonulin receptors.
And the neurological system.
And then there's a part of it that's immunotoxic. So fascinating. How the heck did we survive on pasta all these years? Our ancestors. Maybe there's a change in the wheat. I don't know.
Well, either change in the wheat, it wasn't processed as much.
Yeah.
Because when you go to Italy and you go to a little restaurant and they're making fresh pasta, not that I have it, but patients of mine who are sensitive but not celiac could have it without a problem.
So
there's definitely a change.
There's definitely a change in the food, whether
correct.
It's genetically modified or whatever it is. Yeah.
And that, listen, you could have a whole show on what does genetically modified mean.
Sure, yeah.
You know, so, you know, the diabetes, bringing up the dyslipidemia, which causes, which definitely diabetes leads to heart disease, every diabetic out there should see a cardiologist.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point that I always mention to patients, because they just think, oh, my blood sugar's high, it doesn't mean much. But it really has tremendous ramifications. What actually happens to the arteries of a diabetic if the blood sugar, if the insulin's not working and all that sugar is floating around in the bloodstream?
The arteries get smaller. So for a cardiologist's nightmare is a diabetic who has never seen a cardiologist, finally sees a cardiologist, and they have three-vessel disease in their arteries because the arteries got so small because the sugar insulted them so much through the years and they didn't control their sugar. Most diabetics wind up going on for a bypass, which is not needed, if they would change their diet, take supplements and herbs, and follow a whole lifestyle change. So it's scary because diabetics, you know, I have a sugar of 107, my doctor's not worried about it. What do you mean you're not worried about it? The criteria is now 99.
Yeah.
Even the American Diabetic Association, even though I don't agree with their dietary lifestyle,
yeah,
they have dropped the number from 125 fasting to 110 to now 99.
So basically, they've made it much more of a casting net so that many more people will be caught and labeled, not labeled in a negative way, but labeled diabetic so we can help them.
If they go for help, that's the problem. You have a lot of doctors there that just say, oh, it's 107, just watch your sugar intake. And I'm looking at the blood and saying, well, did he consider an insulin level?
Yeah.
A fasting insulin level? Like if your insulin level is high, or did he do a mini glucose tolerance test? I mean, at Dr. Atkins' office, we used to do 5-hour glucose tolerances almost everyone.
Well,
and everyone had problems.
Yeah.
But now in my office, I don't have to do that, but I could do a 2-hour. They come in, they get a fasting glucose, fasting insulin, they go out to eat the normal breakfast in the area. I come back, they want a 2-hour glucose and a 2-hour insulin, and I could determine if they're diabetic.
Oh, so you don't even give them the nasty glucola stuff. You're just saying, just go eat the regular American fare.
Yeah, let's see what you're going to eat for breakfast, and that'll determine. I said, go eat your regular breakfast. We'll have a protein shake. So let's go have a protein shake then.
Uh-huh.
But so the thing is, and plus I want to do the fancy test for leptin, insulin, ferritin. There's a lot of organic acids, which are inflammatory markers. I really key in on inflammation in my practice, both for heart disease, diabetes, GI. Because inflammation is, that's Fasano has it right. Inflammation starts up these cascade of effects which affect every organ of the body.
Right. So we're at the point in the show where we should really talk about the top 10 supplements for heart disease that you recommend. Gave us that, I don't know, someone gave us that, maybe your publicist. I think it's an important part of the show to talk about that.
Yeah, the thing is, there are 10 favorite supplements. Some of them include herbs. I would have to say through all the research, I think coenzyme Q10, which is now ubiquinol, but coenzyme Q10 is a great supplement for the heart. We need to take it. We don't make it. It's part of the, going back to biochemistry, you and I took, it's the Krebs cycle, which is the energy. We need coenzyme Q10. To make energy of the body. Our energy is termed ATP. It's made in the powerhouse of the cell, seventh grade biology, called the mitochondria. We don't make Q10, so you have to take it. Everyone should take at least 50 to 60 milligrams with or without heart disease. With heart disease, depending on the type, it might go upwards from 100 to 400 and even higher. If anyone is on a statin drug, it was shown in 1979 in the American Journal of Medicine, which is a peer-reviewed journal, that statins deplete CoQ10. So anyone who takes a statin should take CoQ10.
I've never seen a local doctor around here prescribe CoQ10 for any of their patients that they prescribe statin for.
And it's written in a conventional peer-reviewed
literature. I don't
understand. Literature.
I think there should be a big class action lawsuit against the statin companies. Not the doctors, they kind of really don't know probably, but still, they are inducing, it's kind of funny, they're treating heart disease with these supposed lipid-lowering drugs, which we talked about don't work in a lot of cases, and yet they're affecting the main muscle in the body.
Correct.
Which is your heart. So it's kind of, I look at people, and when I explain it to them and they realize it, they get very upset, that's for sure.
And everyone should be on it. And then there's studies even on CoQ10 with Parkinson's disease high dose. So,
right.
You know, one of my good friends who is an integrated cardiologist is Steve Sinatra. He used to practice in Connecticut. He doesn't see a lot of patients. He's more into the nutraceuticals, wrote great books. But, you know, Coenzyme Q10 is on the top list. The next one is L-carnitine, and there's two different. You got acetyl-L-carnitine, which I use for brain function, and then you have L-carnitine. L-carnitine is great for increasing the pump function of the heart, which is the ejection fraction. CoQ10 does that also. So if you got CoQ10 and L-carnitine, and every dose is individualized per patient, but it could be anywhere for my patients from 1,000 to 4,000 a day. L-carnitine is also great for weight loss. So you have a diabetic who's heavy, who has a low pump function. L-carnitine will help the pump function and will also help them lose weight. You could throw an herb in there now that hawthorn does that. Hawthorn is a great positive inotropic. Inotropic in the medicine means a contractor. So hawthorn is great not only to lower blood pressure and heart rate, but increases the contractility of the heart, which makes your muscle strong. So I throw hawthorn in there. Conventional medicine throws a plant in there, and they call it digitalis, but that's foxglove. Unfortunately, a lot of medical doctors today, conventional, don't use digitalis anymore for whatever reason. And I think it still should be used. So you got coenzyme, L-carnitine, hawthorn, taurine, L-taurine. Taurine is a natural diuretic. So it's good for those people with valvular heart disease, especially congestive heart failure where the valves are leaking, to help this. So people who have mitral regurg, which is leakage of the mitral valve, aortic regurg, we don't want fluid to back up into the lungs or into the peripheral vessels where they get edema of fluid of the legs. So I love L-taurine, and that's anywhere from my patients from 1,000 to 3,000. I also could throw an herb in there. I could throw dandelion.
Mm-hmm.
So I use as many nutraceuticals that I like in heart disease and combine them with herbs.
What's your most? You mentioned that inflammation was a big part of your practice and clinical research and treatment goals to lower inflammation in patients. What types of, besides the curcuma, which we already talked a lot about, which ones would you say would lower inflammation?
Well, I like devil's claw.
Okay.
I love, depending if the person has a sensitivity to aspirin, white willow bark.
Right.
I definitely throw in bromelain, which is a nutraceutical.
From pineapple,
and
right?
Yeah. Right. And a great, great thing is oils.
Yeah, we didn't talk much about oils.
Yeah, you need a lot of oils. And there's, you know, unfortunately, there's some bad studies out there. So people are backing off on their oils because their risk of prostate cancer, which was a small study, and it's not true. My patients take omega-3, and it could be derived from a good source of algae or it could be derived from fish. But you need a high omega-3. DHA.
What about eating walnuts and things?
Walnuts
like
are great, but you don't forget. You could get... I'd rather eat quality fish that's been tested from vitalchoice.com where we know there's no mercury,
yeah,
or take a quality fish oil like Nordic Naturals, Eskimo, Vital Choice, Carlson's. I mean, I use all of those oils and eat walnuts as your snacks.
Right, okay.
So, I mean, you know, walnuts are great. I mean, most people prefer, I don't think a lot of people like the aftertaste of a walnut. They like an almond better,
yeah,
but walnuts are so much better.
No, in Chinese medicine, you know, I practice that. You know, walnuts are revered as an anti-aging supplement. Not only does it, you know, doctrine of signatures resemble the brain and things like that, but it seems to be one of these things that builds up the energy of the kidney, which I guess in Chinese medicine is kind of like related to your hormones, balancing testosterone and estrogen, and just giving the body the right fats. Now, what about... That segues me into just a brief mention in the last 5 minutes of the show, talking about balancing hormones. I've read this interesting study that if a guy's vitamin D and testosterone go down, his rate of heart disease goes astronomical. Have you heard
right.
that?
Yes. Well, it's not. So it's, you have to, we used to think it was a total testosterone. It's the free testosterone. And a lot of doctors only measure total. It's actually the free testosterone, which is what's bioavailable. I'm a big proponent of vitamin D. I'm talking 8,000 plus on most of my patients.
So you don't think vitamin D is going to accelerate hardening of the arteries because of what
all.
It does with calcium then?
Well, you have to watch, of course. I'm watching the calcium, the parathyroid. I'm
right.
watching all that. I mean, I'm very careful with vitamin D, but most people are deficient in this country. We all are, especially if you draw a longitudinal line from L.A. to Washington. But I'm talking about those people with severe vitamin D, 20, 18.
Yeah.
Those people need a lot of vitamin D. I'm a big proponent of hormones. I do natural hormonal replacement therapy in my practice. I also give a lot of natural aromatase inhibitors, which I stop men from converting testosterone to estrogen as they get older. So instead
right.
of giving them testosterone shots, which I'm not happy about, or because of prostate cancer risk, or, you know, they have all these lawsuits on the television about testosterone and heart disease. Don't take testosterone. You don't have to take testosterone because it'll stop your own production. But you could take bioflavonoids like quercetin, chrysin, pomegranate.
Right. So these are things that kind of make sure that whatever testosterone you make doesn't get sabotaged and
correct.
Put down into a different pathway, or what worse, go down the stress pathway, because with the tremendous amount of stress that people are under, they take their precursors for all the hormones and they move them into the
stress
pathway.
Right.
And I know David Winston wrote a great book. We had him on the show a while back talking about the different herbs that are adaptogens that kind
of
help the adrenals and things like that with the stress.
We could have a show on adrenal fatigue.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back and talk about herbs for adrenals and then also your work with herbs for first aid with Seven Song. I know that's one of
his. Oh, God, yeah. That's my favorite. That was my favorite lecture.
Yeah, because you wouldn't think that herbs could be used for first aid purposes. You'd think, oh, I better run to the emergency room. I got, you know, but there's quite a number of things that can be done with that. Well, and tell us a little bit about how people can get in touch with you and in your, in three words, define life and your philosophy.
Life, hope, laughter, and sincerity. I mean, I have to tell you, you can get in touch with me at 212-421-3202. We have a website, fratellonemedical.com, and it's fratellonemedical.com. From that, you could link to a daily blog. I write a fresh blog every day myself about 5 o'clock in the morning. I write it whatever I'm thinking of that day. It has been on for 4 years. And then we link for those people that do not want to go on Facebook. We have a link on our website to social media. So, and I give lectures and we post everything. I'm just a happy guy. I'm great. I tell you what, really, but I am grateful because this past weekend, I celebrated 20 years of continuous sobriety,
which
has changed my life.
Oh,
and I have to tell you, I'm a better doctor because of that.
Yeah, excellent.
So, I mean, jokingly, hope and sincerity, truth, honesty. I mean, it's all about, I want to tell the patient the truth about what's going on, even if it's going to cost me a lot in my future, because, you know, the AMA doesn't like me.
Oh.
You know, no one likes any doctor that practices the way we do.
Yeah. Well, we're kind of lucky in a way that naturopaths, we're just kind of, we go to school to be on the outside from the get-go, and then sometimes, and our license, you know, my license says I can do kind of herbal medicine and things like that.
Yeah, so that's, you know, so as a medical doctor, I needed the certification as an
herbalist
to do what I do.
Yeah.
Because, you know, people in the conventional medicine doesn't understand herbs, and if they understood herbs, we would all get along.
Yeah. Dr. Fratellone, we really appreciate your joining us and making cardiology fairly simple. I mean, you broke it down into some very interesting concepts, makes it a tough thing very easy to understand. This show is a keeper, folks. You can certainly download it a little later on from the website. And thanks very much, and we'll have you on again.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, and that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z telling you to stay healthy, folks. Bye-bye.